Now let's just talk about what it really means to be a teacher. Kids are really amazing, you know, and every time they will surprise you when you least expect it. I was teaching in Milwaukee to, a pretty much an inner city school. A lot of the kids came from homes without a lot of extras, no doubt. And they were just third and fourth graders. In fact, they sort of met behind the boiler room. I mean, that actually was their classroom. And so I just had been teaching them some singing and dancing, and they were so cute. We had decided that for costumes, we would just get them in blue jeans and white shirts and tennis shoes. Well, that was a real problem for some of them. I mean, a lot of them showed up with the strangest combination of blue jeans tied together with string or pinned together with lots of safety pins, white shirts that were every shape and size with writing on them or something that you couldn't tell where they picked them up, and tennis shoes that didn't have shoelaces or big holes in them. And I just was feeling so bad about it, mainly because I thought, you know, this is America. I mean, kids, I mean, you kind of expect it maybe in a foreign country where kids have less. But here in our rich, rich country, kids just shouldn't have to live like this. And I was feeling really bad and just kind of looking at them and thinking of that. And one kid looked up at me and looked right at me, about a third grader, and he said, "You know, you really need some new clothes." He didn't need my pity for an instant. He really put me in my place, and I once again was reassured that every kid out there has a real strong mind and a real strong heart for where he needs to be. I spent a lot of years working for Walt Disney Productions, and I always remember one story about Winnie the Pooh, probably one of my favorite characters, about how Pooh and Christopher Robin were at sleep at night, and Christopher is talking over to Winnie the Pooh and just saying, "Pooh, Pooh, Pooh." And finally Winnie the Pooh says, "What? What is it?" And Christopher says, "Oh, nothing. I just wanted to be sure of you." I think so often that applies so relevantly to music teachers and teachers in general. The students really don't want very much of you. They just want to be sure that when they show up there in the morning, there's going to be somebody there who cares about them, who values them, who treasures them, who cares what happens to them. It may not be happening at home. It may not be happening anyplace else in their life. But there at school, they need to know that you're there, that they can count on you, that they can be sure of you. I was reading the latest Harris poll, and I saw that 69% of all Americans would pay an additional $5 in taxes to support the arts. 75% oppose government restrictions on content. 91% favor vigorous arts education in the schools. For Americans in the 1990s, the arts stand in the center of life, not on its margins or in its shadows. Music and the arts in general are not a frill. They are an important, in fact, essential part of the human experience. I just recommend that all students study the arts, and I think that we're finding out that so do most citizens of the United States. They believe in this. They believe the arts are valuable. They believe that they are not extracurricular. They're an important part of every kid's development. It's so hard, I think, to be a teacher sometimes in this day and age, especially I think to be a teacher of the arts. It's so easy for school boards and superintendents and even parents and perhaps even the rest of the faculty to look at teachers of the arts and say, well, there's a place when the budget comes around, we can cut there. Surely we don't need that. Yes, we need science. Yes, we need all of this. We need math. We need English. We need language skills. But we can cut somewhere there in the arts. And it's so hard as a music teacher or an arts teacher in general to keep your pride up, to keep believing in what you do, even though you think you know that in truth there is something to what you're saying and what you're teaching. I guess what I want to tell you is not to move into some world where you're all alone with yourself and your mantra and your fitness program or whatever it is that you might use to try to control the world by closing it out. As misguided as our schools may at sometimes seem, with declining budgets, higher student-to-teacher ratio, varying degrees of support for teachers and administrators, we need to decide to just live in this mess. Throw yourself out there into the convulsions of the world and participate in it. I'm not saying that every day you will make it better. I'm just telling you to live in it. Witness it. Care about it. Try to get it. Take chances. Make your own work. Take pride in it despite the hurdles. Seize the moment. I just have a fear that there are people that will live and die with the music still in them. And as teachers, we have the opportunity to bring that music out, whatever beautiful form it might take. I just want you teachers to lean in really close right now and listen like you've never listened before. Because the older I get, I guess the less I feel absolutely sure about, absolutely positive about. But I'm going to tell you one thing right now that I absolutely know. And I have a really loud microphone, and you just need to listen. You need to lean forward and imagine that you're looking right into my eyes, because here is one thing that I know to be the absolute truth. You are valuable. It does not matter if you are big or little, tall or short, quick or slow, funny or dull. It does not matter if you are black or white, brown or red, pink, purple, yellow, or covered with rainbow-colored polka dots. It doesn't matter if you're Christian, Jew, Muslim, Buddhist, Shinto, Hindu, or loudmouth Lutheran from Lithuania. It does not matter if you're gay, straight, bi, or in love with a chimpanzee. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, Socialist, Communist, or even a tenor. I'm telling you right here and right now that it does not matter if you wear $150 Armani blue jeans or run around in a gunny sack, if you have blonde hair, black hair, no hair, or hair like a chia pet, clear skin or occasional blemish or a face full of zits and uncontrolled flaking. If anyone makes you think different, you send them to me because they are wrong. And I'm right now telling you this, and I'm pretty pumped up. I'm telling you, and I'm telling you, and I'm telling you, and you, and you, and 4,000 times you, that you are valuable. And I, we, they, he, she, and the big it needs you. And you need to believe that. I come from a whole family of teachers. My dad was the superintendent of schools. My mom was an elementary school teacher. And I'm one of 10 kids. And they're all teachers. 10 for 10. There was one brother who was sort of a holdout for a while. He got into real estate, thought he was going to make a real living, I guess. But he succumbed eventually and went back to school and got his degree and now is a high school history teacher. And the really wild thing is that not only are they all my brothers and sisters teachers, but they all married teachers. Well, there is the one smart sister who married a doctor. But actually, that's really funny too, because now he is teaching at med school. So everybody in my family is a maniac like me about teaching. It's just it's a wonderful way to spend your life. We really believe in it, and we have all had pretty good lives. It's also a great profession to raise families, to be involved with your own family, to keep things in perspective. I think if you ever lose hope, you just got to hang around young people, hang around kids. Teachers usually maintain pretty good hope. If you hang around a kid who's like, say, sixth grade, he can't wait to get into junior high. Well, a junior high kid, seventh grader, say, can't wait to be an eighth grader. An eighth grader can't wait to get into high school, so they're real excited about that. You know, they're into ninth grade. Well, nobody wants to be a ninth grader, so they can't wait to be an upperclassman. And when you're upperclassman, you can't wait to graduate and get out into the real world or to college. And if they only knew that they had a good right there. But anyway, when you're around that kind of hope, it's hard for you not to remain hopeful. I think we need to remember that as teachers. The bottom line is, though, we are all sort of guilty, I think especially as music teachers, of working from the outside in life in general, but also just in our productions, in our shows, in our work in the classroom. We sort of lay in bed at night and consider what our Christmas show is going to be like. I mean, I have my sort of ultimate glitz story. I'll never forget the day that Gary Paben, manager of special events at Walt Disney World, bounded into the office we shared above Main Street, USA, literally leapt on top of his desk, spread out his arms, and cried, "Hey, John, we got the Goodyear blimp." What follows has to have been the most profound example of glitz that I or anyone else ever witnessed. Anyone who knows Gary would certainly not be surprised at his less than subtle display of enthusiasm. But in this particular instance, the news was such a topper that it wasn't long before I was up on the desk with him. The thing that really would surprise a stranger to our entertainment division offices was that none of the other people in the offices even blinked an eye or came running out to see if we had finally flipped. I guess the Halloween show we did the week before with tap dancing Frankenstein and a 40-foot-tall singing Dracula had already convinced them of our insanity. A simple soft shoe and a roll top was a relatively run-of-the-mill. Nonetheless, getting the Goodyear blimp was worthy of excitement for the two of us. Excitement that didn't wane until the dirigible had done its thing and the cleat-marked desk was replaced with a runway. The hoopla centered around the fact that Gary and I were in charge of putting together a production that would appropriately serve as the grand opening celebration of the new airport in Orlando, Florida. Actually, the board of directors for the airport had approached us to produce what they kind of labeled as an entertaining ribbon-cutting ceremony with a few dignitaries, a few speeches, and a low budget. The budget was only a few thousand dollars. Now, I know that seems like a fortune to most music educators who realize that that figure probably represents their entire music program's allotment during their 35-year career as a teacher. But when you start having to pay union rates for all your performers, technical people, rehearsal time, props, and all that stuff, it really doesn't amount to much at all. What it does do is force creative thinking to its limits, not to mention creative budgeting. You know all about that. A few weeks later, we had what I would label a million-dollar pile of glitz, and entertainment at its biggest, if not its best. The entire ceremony, which took place in and above the new airport's giant parking lots, lasted less than 20 minutes. Those 20 minutes included participation by the U.S. Marine Air Corps Band, the skydivers holding American flags as they descended, a dozen Rolls Royces delivering the dignitaries, eight rolling staircases, those kind that unload planes. Now they were filled with representative flight attendants from the respective airline companies. 40 dancers on six decorated hydraulic lifts normally used for putting the food into the airplanes. 50 choreographed signal flag personnel on the roof of the airport. 200 American flags and bearers on another level of the airport facade, 80 volunteer dancers, and let's see, we had 36 professional dancers, a full orchestra, 36 students carrying 16-foot banners bigger than themselves, 14 choreographed biplanes, two stunt pilots and their planes making patterns with the smoke in the sky, literally tons of fireworks, 20,000 helium balloons, 18 Air Force jets and colored smoke trails, hundreds of white doves, a DC-10, a 747, and oh yes, the Goodyear blimp. The only thing that I can think that we actually forgot was the ribbon cutting. It was the kind of production that can never be fully rehearsed. You wind up practicing each segment kind of on its own and hope that what's happening in your mind is also going to happen during the one-shot performance. Luckily, except for the fact that we nearly burned down the brand new airport with an overdose of fireworks, and the reality that the airport's maintenance personnel were still calling us weeks later, begging us to come back and collect our pigeons, we like to call them doves, who were messing up their skylights, it was a flying success. Best of all, it made me even more aware of the inexhaustible possibilities in entertainment and the reality that a little glitz, or a lot, can make even a simple ribbon cutting into a memorable experience. But you know, the one thing the glitz story really brings home to me is that back where we really started, where Gary and I really began, was back with the music, right at the very core. Long before Gary Pabin had made his flying leap onto my homework, we knew that our production, of whatever scale, was going to be a soaring success because we had good music. The one element of quality we knew we had secure was the foundation of our entire project. That was the music. Long before the choreography was taught, costumes designed, or balloons inflated, the music had been chosen and rehearsed. We knew through our ears and our hearts that if all we did was play the music, the event would still be moving and memorable. It would be a musical work of art. Hence, the great joy for us as producers was the fact that anything we added to that already successful foundation would simply amplify it and embellish its effectiveness. Every banner, flag, balloon, or blimp would be the frosting on an already tasty dessert. All it took was an incredible, yet feasible amount of planning. So I'm not really here to suggest that all of you should go out and have 14 biplanes, the Marine Band, and Air Force jets in your next rendition of Fly Me to the Moon. After all, most high school or college auditoriums are not quite that big. But perhaps the suggestion of starting from the base, starting from the absolute core, which in your case is the music, and adding a little bit here, a little bit there, will help you as a teacher make your message even more impressive. Amplify it so that it becomes even more effective to your students and to your audiences. I think lying in bed at night and somewhere back in September dreaming of the flying reindeer in your Christmas pageant is a wonderful thing, but only if first you've made it crystal clear that the music was important. And in general, I think as teachers, we need to back beyond even the music, back to the real core of why we enter the classroom, and that is the student. How does this choice of a show, of a lesson plan, of a piece of music help make this student a better artist, and even more than that, a better person? We don't have to teach. We get to. Oh, goodness gracious, you can always fall back on performing. I love teaching, and I love music as much as anything that I can ever imagine. Music just makes my heart so full. Teaching music makes it overflow. You're right. You'll absolutely never get rich being a teacher. You'll probably never get rich being an artist. But with the power and influence that you have as a musician, as an artist, as a teacher, you will never be poor. When taught with passion and commitment, any subject, but I think particularly the arts and humanities, prepares students to imagine and to create. Creative students become creative executives, scientists and inventors, as well as, like, composers and choreographers, novelists, painters, and video artists. Unless we can imagine new uses of computers, new forms for products, new content for media, VCR, cellular phones, satellite videos, fiber optics, and computers, we are finished as a global competitor. In a post-industrial international market, ideas, design, creativity, and ingenuity are legitimate bread and butter words. The growth and support of American culture matters. You know, the thing about being a teacher, I've always thought, especially a music teacher, is that in your art, you probably have more training than any other profession. Good grief, most musicians have been practicing their art since they were tiny little children, and they have never stopped. That's much more training than any measly years it takes to become a lawyer, a doctor, or a nuclear physicist. When the question comes up as to whether or not we need art specialists in our schools, I can't imagine any parent wanting their child's education in the hands of someone with any less experience than a lifetime of education. From you, they get the truth of art. And you get to illuminate the truth and the human condition to your kids. You know, your role as a teacher doesn't really stop at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. As a politician, I think there are areas that you should not or do not have to explain. The same is sort of true of a theologian or an artist and most other walks of life. But as a teacher, your commitment is total. And I know you're thinking right now, that sounds so exhausting. And in reality, it kind of is. You know, and it gets harder every single year. You have a whole bunch of students. You just get them to where you think they're really ready to go and really, really polished off, and they graduate. And you're thinking, well, that was a job well done. And in comes a whole nother row. They send you a whole nother classroom, and you've got to start all over again. It never gets easy. As a music teacher especially, I always think of the fact that, you know, Aunt Clara comes to the show in the spring of the year, your final concert of the year, and she absolutely loves it. She loves seeing her little children up there making beautiful music. So she goes away for summer vacation, and she calls, you know, the other relative across the country, and she's telling them about this program. And in her mind, by the time she gets home, it was the greatest thing in this little town. That's about July. Now, August rolls around, and you have the family reunion, and she's telling some more relatives about it. And it was indeed the finest thing ever put on stage ever in the history of humankind. Well, by the time you get back to school, you're starting already having to deal with those expectations. And when Aunt Clara comes back to the spring concert the next year, in her mind, the reality of what you produced last year is unbelievable. It's absolutely unrealistic, but you can't afford to let Aunt Clara down. That's an incredible amount of pressure. I think it's sort of like that story of the starfish. It's an old story that is not mine, but I think it says it absolutely right. Because so many times we feel that it's overwhelming. There's too many kids. The teacher-to-student ratio is way out of whack. There's no way we can possibly give individual attention to every student that needs it, particularly music teachers who sometimes see 200, 300, 400, 500 kids in a day. It's unbelievable. And it's like that story of the starfish where the old guy is walking along the beach and the tide has just gone out. And there are a million starfish spread out on the beach, millions of them. And they're going to dry up and die in the sun before the tide can ever come in again and give them water. So this old guy is walking along and picking up the starfish that are still living one at a time and tossing them back out into the ocean. Picks up another one, tosses it out into the ocean. Well, this young guy comes along and says, "What are you doing? What in the world are you doing? Look at, there are a million, a gazillion starfish out there. There is absolutely no way that what you're going to do is make any difference. They're all going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it." And the old guy just keeps picking them up one at a time, and throw them out, and he says, "You know, you're right. I won't be able to get to all of them. But it's going to make a big difference to the few that I pick up and throw back out into the water. You're probably not going to get to every student that walks into your classroom. You may not be able to save them all. But to those that you do reach, you're going to make all the difference in the world. You're going to save their very life." Oh, the weight of that on your shoulders is unbelievable. It's inhuman. But what a privileged responsibility. I don't know. I really am a maniac about being a teacher. I think it's the most profound profession in the history of mankind. Really. Really, of all the professions, of all the occupations, of all the ways that you could choose life, I think it's the most noble. Think about it. Think of the most amazing people you've ever thought of in the history of humankind. And I'm talking about the biggies. I'm talking about Buddha. I'm talking about Muhammad. And I'm talking about Jesus Christ himself. And if nothing else, tell me one word that describes who these people are, who these individuals in the history of humankind were. If nothing else, they were teachers. They were all remarkable, the best ever teachers. You walk in the footsteps of saints. You breathe the same air, think the same thoughts, provide the same function as the greatest beings in the history of humankind. And I don't care if that sounds corny, and I don't care if it sounds preachy. This is our whole life. It is a lonely profession. My picture of a music teacher is my elementary school teacher, sort of 17 concerts in one night. She's pushing the spinet across the gym floor. She can hardly walk. Her feet are so swollen from the high heels she's been wearing as she conducts. And one more kid comes up to her with yet another pin shaped like a treble clef. Merry Christmas. And you roll the piano to the window and you look out and you think, I'm all alone. There is nobody else out there who's doing this. There is nobody else out there who understands at all. It's just me. I'm working myself to death, and I'm all alone. Well, you have to remember who your peers are and who they have been throughout the history of humankind, and understand that you're dealing with the most valuable thing we have. These are our children. And you have them in your hands. And you are valuable. We all have students that inspire us. I remember doing an America Sings Festival last year in California. And all I can do really at those festivals is sort of walk around and kind of grin and smile and cheerlead for the most of the day, trying to make everybody feel good about it. We set up 3 or 4 or 5 stages, and everybody performs for a half an hour from like 9 in the morning till 6 at night, and then we do a mass concert. It's a thrilling day of sharing and sharing our music and our art and happiness, but it is exhausting. After you've watched some maybe 60, 70, maybe hundreds of choirs in one day, you just can hardly listen or even stand up anymore. But every time I would go to stage number 3 in our certain festival, there was this one young guy there named Daniel. And Daniel would come and stand right next to me. He must have been, I suppose, about fourth grade. And he was crippled. He had sort of malformed legs. And he was one of those kind of kids that we all have, you know, the kind that sort of are there after school and before school, hanging around, hanging on you a little closer than you'd wish. Maybe isn't quite as clean as you wish he could be if he's going to hang all over you. Cleans enough erasers for the whole school. But a great, great kid. And every time I would stand by that one stage watching the kids perform, Daniel would come right there and stand next to me and look up at me and look at the stage and kind of just like standing there. And I'd sort of stand there with him. Well, by 4 in the afternoon, I'm telling you, I am exhausted. Exhausted. And it's like about the last couple of choirs of the day, and I walk over to that stage and I stand there again. And Daniel comes up and stands next to me, and I just sort of sigh and go, "Well, I wonder what group this is." And Daniel looked up at me and said, "Well, that's Westlake High School from Westlake, California." And I looked down at Daniel and I said, well, thanks, Daniel. And he slipped his arm around my waist and he said, "That's okay, John. That's what friends are for." You have remarkable peers, teachers. You are not alone. There are teachers like you all over the country, all over the world, who have the same sort of love for their art and for their craft as you do, who also had 17 concerts that night and had to push their spinet across the floor and got a treble clef. You simply need to go out and look out that window that you're staring out and understand that there are other music teachers, noble, wonderful people, looking at the same stars as you are, dreaming the same dreams, caring for their kids in the same way you are. And you just have to keep going. Because that's what friends are for. So call each other up. Give each other encouragement. Sometimes I think we as music teachers are our own worst enemies. We battle it out. We compete in our art. We want our kids, our 30, 40, 50, 60 kids, to have a better experience than the choir or the band down the road. That's so misguided. Every kid is your responsibility. Every single kid in the whole wide world is your responsibility if you call yourself a teacher. Yes, that's an impossible task. I don't care. That's your assignment. You need to do it. The world needs you to do that. And you breathe the air of saints and walk in the footsteps of remarkable people, of Muhammad, of Buddha, of Jesus Christ. You know, I always have tried to live my life by three-word phrases. Simple, so do other people. I love you. That's pretty sound. God is love. Whatever your definition of that is, I think for sure that is a truth. Fate is kind. That was from my Disney years, you know. Things just sort of work out. I sometimes, in fact, along those lines, think that the world is just sort of like a good vamp, kind of going along. God's kind of playing this vamp, 1-4-5-1, 1-4-5-1, just kind of waiting for us to figure it out. Oh, yeah, once in a while he plays a little melody in the right hand just to make it interesting. And I think even the last chord is going to be sort of in minor, keep us kind of thinking, keep us really pondering our fate. And then on the last chord, there'll be a Picardy third, because that's so filled with joy. Fate is kind. Things work out. Well, I've added a fourth three-word phrase to my vocabulary now. After I love you, God is love, fate is kind, and teachers, don't get tired. Don't get tired of talking about it, teaching it, motivating, cheerleading, working at your craft, going to workshops, reading books, studying your music. Don't ever get tired of battling the school board for something that you believe in, campaigning to the superintendent and to the other faculty. Don't get tired of doing it. Don't get tired of going to those summer workshops and putting on your sweatsuits and dancing if that's what it takes. Don't get tired of it. Don't get tired of your children. They need you. We all need you. And then I think you'll understand and you'll remember why you got into all of this. You'll see the Daniels of the world. And you'll know that when they come to school in the morning, they can be sure of you. And you'll remember that you chose right.